So we're dedicating this class, firstly, for all of the Jewish people, especially those who live in the Holy Land, in our Holy Land, especially for the IDF soldiers that are standing right now willing and ready to sacrifice even their lives to protect all of the Jews around the world, and also for Ido Tuvia Ben La'at,
Mayan Bat Marcel,
Gittel Bat Shoshana Rezel,
Levi Hirsch Ben Bat Sheva.
They are wounded. They should have a refuah shleima. Oh, these are okay. These are soldiers that we know. We have Menachem, Nisim, soldiers from Solem, and all the Yidden, and also Le'ilu Nishmas, Perel Fredel Bas Masleib. Okay. All right. So the theme, I think, is important because it's practical. We're familiar with it. What I would like to share from the Rebbe is also something that we are familiar with, but it's good to revisit the familiar on occasion, because there is knowing in your mind, and then there's actually integrating it and practicing it, and that makes all the difference in the world. So I want to speak about the mitzvah of challah, and I want to begin with a cute story. The story is not what you think it is. I'm saying that right now, and we'll get back to it soon. Not that long ago, there was a big Rav in Eretz Yisrael that towards the end of his life, he became blind. And it's amazing, the human mind. Some people don't lose their minds, which is gavaldik. It's good to know that. Halavai and all of us. So in his blindness, he remained the head of the Beis Din. He had a tremendous memory. And he was the go-to. That means he had you know, younger people that were knowledgeable, but whenever something really was complex, they would bring it to him. And he was listening to what was happening to some level. And what happened is like this, that a woman separated challah. What we do nowadays is that we burn it and discard it. If the challah was not burnt or prior to burnt, if it gets mingled, mixed in with the dough, who knows what the law is?
Cut it after Hamotzi.
Huh?
You cut it after Hamotzi and put it aside, right?
Nope. First of all, people don't know. You don't know because it never happened to you. So it's nishkefra, it doesn't matter.
But the piece of the afresh
shasal. Yeah, what happens if the piece of afresh shasal, it's a technical. The part of the class will be technical.
Hamotzi came in.
Yeah, what? No, if it's burnt, it's discernible. You'll see. But before you burnt it, if it were to happen, so even though that generally in halacha, you know, you have this ratio of 60-1 nullification. Yeah. Also practical. That means it happens in the kitchen. You're cooking too. There's nothing wrong. You have a stovetop. You don't even have to have designated. But we have it. Here in America, with the wealth I have in my house, 6 or 4, we designate stovetops for milchiks and fleishiks. Common sense is maybe not to do it at the same time. It's common sense. But if you did it at the same time, everything is okay. Unless something from this pot spritzed into that pot. So this is something that happens in many kitchens. There is a mixture of meat and milk. And generally, I know, boring but technical, ratio 60-1. If there was 60 meat volume and 1 of milk, or the other way around, it's called batel, butel, nullified. Challah is like truma. It has to have a ratio of 100-1. And let me tell you something, that when you make a dough, even though you remove a small amount, not so simple that you had 100 more. 100 is a lot. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. But if you have to know, if you did not have the ratio of 101, everything has to be burnt. There's no way, there's no fixing it. We're living right now in abundance. Even the people that are struggling, not to minimize their struggle, but when people were hungering, it was a problem. You can't waste that dough. You people have to eat. So the story was, is that a woman walked into a Beis Din, and that's what happened to her. She separated the challah. Someone else, you know, many people are in the kitchen. It can happen. These things could happen. It got remixed. Even though she separated challah later, but she became aware that before she separated, someone else separated and it got mixed in. Now it's too late. What should you do?
What What if it wasn't baked yet? Like, it's not after, like, in a moment, can we mix it all and do it again?
No, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what happened to her. In other words, there were probably, I don't know the details, let's say that her daughter, someone else, another woman separated, got mixed back in. She didn't even know about it. And at some point, she was mafresh challah. It's too late. If when it got mixed in, if you separated, and if it got remingled and you mixed it together, if you don't have 100 more,
it's not batel b'shishim,
batel b'meya. But you have to have meya. That's what I'm saying. So even though she later separated, challah wasn't good. Okay, so what happens? So they paskined that the whole batch, whatever she made, the bread. In Israel, these are poor people, poor. So the blind man, guys, it's not what you think. The blind man asked the Dayanim, one second. He didn't want to ashamed them. He called over and he asked them, tell me how she's dressed. So they described how she's dressed. He says, tell her she can have it. Gesundheit. Now this is really a riddle. What is... Listen, you're going to see, you're going to say, aha. I'm going to leave the riddle not for the end of the class. I want to share a few technical parts of challah with a very deep question, with a very deep answer. The answer you know, but I want to show you how it's connected to challah and to challenge me and you to live this, not just to know this, because you know this. First of all, the mitzvah of challah is a mitzvah biblically to be practiced in the Holy Land. By rabbinic law, we practice it everywhere. The mitzvah of challah has two parts to it. There are two parts to the mitzvah of challah. One we practice, one we don't. The first mitzvah is to separate. To separate, just to be clear, any type of dough, not batter, I don't know how you say this in modern Hebrew, batter is when you mix flour with stuff, but you can pour it halachically. That's the definition of a batter. It's pourable. Dough, the definition of dough is that it's solid. So that's why by cake, no one is mafresh challah, even though the ingredients are the same, just on the side. If you make a product that has in it, from the five grains, any one of or some of a few, wheat, barley, oats, rice, spelt. Very simple. Remember, these are the five grains. Alpi halacha. Everything else is not called tvua. It's not called grain. And there are many other things. You have rice. Today you have quinoa. Today you have who knows what. Potato starch. I mean, we suffer Pesach. We know not even kidney is how to make flours. And we're getting better at it. But halachically, we're speaking about a product made with the five grains, mixed with water, dough, not batter. So we have a mitzvah in Israel, biblically, when all the Jews lived there. I don't want to get into that. That means even nowadays in Israel, it's not biblical. Chutz la'aretz, rabbinically, to separate. How much do you have to separate? Who knows? So very good. I want to tell you how it got there. From the Torah, mashu. Mashu means anything. Rabbinically, they said, well, depends. If you are a baker, 1 of 48. If you're a balabasta, you're not professional. That means you're not mass producing, 1 of 24.
I don't measure.
I know that. 1 second. Oh, I want to get to that. That's step number one. I want to just explain how it got to what you're saying. You said so good, Kezias, but Kezias is a minig. I want you to know how we got there. And even though if a woman never heard Kezias, don't worry. Midoiraisa, any separation. Midrabanan, no, yeah, there's a minimum. 1/48. 1/48 is a little bit more than 2%, right? 1 from 50 is 2 from 100, is 2%. And 1/48 is 2 point, whatever the exact math is, which is a very small amount. Very small amount. And by the way, if it's 2%, if it falls back in, it's a low batel b'meya. Batel b'meya, even if you take 1%, if I take 1%, what's left? 99. If it falls back into it, everything is not good. Ratio has to be 100. People who love halacha, they're so happy about this. People that don't like halacha, they're falling asleep. Don't fall asleep. I just want to do this because we live this halacha. Okay. A Balabasta 1.24. 1.24, again, if it would be 1 in 25, it would be 4%. It's a little bit more than 4%. 1 of 24. Second part of the mitzvah is to give it to a kohen for the kohen to eat it. This is part of the mitzvah. There's a problem. There's a challenge. That nowadays, aside of the fact that there's a question whether the kohanim, with all the biggest mechila to all the kohanim, you have, the kohanim are called kohanim miyuchasim, yichus, geja, which means we presume. That's really what it means halachically. You're from the yichus, but you're not muhzak. These are the words in halacha. Muhzak means we don't know for sure. How would you know for sure? You have to have a lineage of who your father was, who his father was, and people used to have that, going back to someone who worked in the Beis Hamikdash.
Does anyone have that?
There are some families that have that. Mamash. It's amazing. A big part of the function of the Sanhedrin in the Beis Hamikdash was to go through people's pedigree to see whether you're qualified, whether you're, and all of the dirty secrets came out. Because even if you have a pedigree, don't ask. I mean, all of the uncomfortable mistakes of the past came up in the Sanhedrin, and they were very good at getting to that, not to publicize it, but to find out what's what, who is who. Not everyone qualified to work in the Beis Hamikdash. Okay, so first of all, we don't know for sure whom to give it to, but that's the least problem. The bigger problem is that we are all in this state of ritual impurity because we have halachic contact with a corpse. All of us have. We went to the Beis HaChaim. We did a mitzvah. We buried someone. We're tamei. The food is tamei. I'm tamei. Everything is tamei. And therefore, even if I were to know for sure who the kohen is not allowed to eat it. The only thing the kohen can do with it is burn it. Once it has to get burnt anyway, and I don't even know for sure who a kohen is, first of all, I don't have to give it to the kohen. I have to burn it. Number two, since it's not going to be eaten, the rabbinic law of giving minimum 1/48, 1/24, we say, no, what's the point? What's the point? It's going to get burnt. The reason why the sages gave you a minimum amount, it's like when someone comes and knocks on your door. Someone asks you for tzedakah, right? You're not going to give him a penny. Well, a penny is nothing. A penny is not nothing. There is a certain feeling of someone already made the effort and they're coming to ask you for help. Whatever your thing is, whatever your people give, everyone has their. So the Chachamim felt you're giving something to a kohen, what you're making a big tchala and you're going to give him a mashahu. It's not nice. So they made the minimum amounts. But since it's getting burnt, so the rabbinic minimum amounts fall to the side. Lo shayach. It's not relevant. So really we're back to the mashahu. The minhag Yisrael made by women, by you people, is to make a kezayis. Also, like you're doing a mitzvah, same like you're doing a mitzvah. You know, kezayis is the standard size of eating. When God says, don't eat. So what does it mean by eating? Eating does not mean nibbling. Nibbling is not eating. Eating means a kezayis. So it became a minhag to take a kezayis, but since it's only a minhag, no one measures it, and many women don't even know that. But they, if you saw your mother doing it, you remember that she didn't take off a mashahu, that you remember. She didn't take off a nothing, she took off something, a something. The something is a kezayis. Okay. Now, another thing that's very important to remember, just some technical rules of challah. If you forgot to take off challah, you can rectify the mistake. When are you supposed to take off challah? Who knows?
When you're doing the bracha. Like
no, I know, but when do you do the bracha? After kneading. I want you to know this is the only mitzvah food related that's in middle of a product. The only one. Almost all of the gifts that we gave from food that we'll give when Mashiach will come, you give truma and maaser, and you give either raw product, mamish raw, or final product. Especially a gift to a poor. You don't give to the poor dough. It's not nice. Don't help. You want to help? Give the person a piece of bread. Money or bread. We don't give in middle. It has to be explained. In middle of it. What's in middle? It's not raw. But you made dough. So it's after you mix the flour and the water. And by the way, many people add other things. They add honey. They add salt. These things are very significant in the details of the mitzvah of challah. The meaning of it. You know, the chesed, and the gevura and all that. But I'm saying you have a dough. You're supposed to separate it from when you have a dough. If you forgot to separate it, no problem. In the oven, if it's in the oven, when you remove it from the oven, separate it then. But here's the big but. And that's the final technical thing I want to share, which is very relevant. Hashem gave us the mitzvah of challah. God spoke about a quantity. The quantity that God spoke about is called a tenth of an ephah. These are biblical measurements. What does that mean? We're living in America. It goes by, we're going to go with weight, pounds. There's a big debate as to what's the minimum amount of flour, not of dough. Because in the dough, you added water, you added eggs. I don't know what you add. You add a lot of things. What's the minimum amount of flour that you need from which you're chayev to take challah? So because of the differences of opinions, I'm giving you the way the Chabad world and most of the Ashkenazic world, everyone is close to what I'm saying, either close or exact. Less than 2.5 pounds, you don't separate challah. You don't separate challah. You're not even doing something beyond the letter of the law.
It's a kilo.
I think, yeah, is it? I'm not sure. Thank you. So then I stand corrected, because if you're from Israel, a kilo is 2.2. Now, once you have this kilo or the 1 to 2.2, I heard 2.5, but it doesn't make a difference. From there, no, you're right. You're not wrong. I understand why. Because even when you have 1 kilo of flour or 2.2, you don't make a bracha. You're not allowed to make a bracha.
But you separate it.
You separate it without a bracha. The question is, from what point do you make a bracha? So we go with 5 pounds. But according to you, it would be a 4.4. Yeah. What was that? The kilo is 2.2.
Yeah.
But this is mama shit. This is it.
So 1,000 grams.
1,000 grams
is a kilo.
4.8. So 2,000 grams. 2,000. So 2,000 grams, we make a bracha. Less than that, we don't make a bracha. I know. I grew up in other groups. I remember 3 and 5 in pounds. 3 and 5, 2 and 4. This is it. In Lubavitch, it's going to be 5 pounds. But I'm sure in Eretz Yisrael, they say it's a fine, because you have so many different opinions, you have room to lean on. It's good to remember that. Because there are times that people, this is practical, you make
a... Separate anyways?
And what we do don't... So, no, one second. In other words, if I am making, if you're making a small nash,
yeah. Like 12 cups of flour.
If it's not, I don't know cups. If it's not 1 kilo, you don't separate challah. Not you don't make a bracha. You don't separate challah.
Because it's embarrassing.
No, because the obligation of God was only really on 4 point. Mm-hmm. Hashem gave a minimum amount, prior to which there's no mitnah. Listen, if you want to give tzedakah, mm-hmm. We never say that by tzedakah. We never say, like, let's say a person is going to give 10%. We never tell a person, well, if you only earned $1, then you don't give tzedakah. We don't say it there. I'm talking about challah, and I'll tell you why. There's a reason. That's what the class is about. There's a shir. And they were like, why not? That's a good question. What get into the habit of getting challah. And so take a half a kezayis, because it's not a kezayis, it's a minig. No, if you're doing less than that, and that goes back to the story. The story was, is the Rav wanted to hear from the way she was dressed. He heard the distress. Most people, I know that people are poor, but Mistami, he heard from when they said that you have to burn it, the oy that she gave, he heard that this is a very poor woman. Guys, poor, we don't know poor. Poor, he thought maybe she had no money to have 2 pounds of flour. So when they described she was dressed, Mishnah, they described that she was wearing real rags. We don't know what shmata clothing is. When he heard the way she was dressed, he said it must be that the amount that she made was nothing. So the whole thing is not a problem. For sure, less than the 4. You can be lenient. You can say now that if it wasn't for 4.5 or 5 pounds, who had money for that? From the way that was his chachma. Okay, but I want to come back to the. So there's many things.
How they describe her clothing?
That they never told us to be able to figure out. Because when you tell a religious rabbi how was she dressed, everyone's brain, including yours, was she dressed modestly or not modestly? And then you think, what does that have to do with anything? Does it mean that if she's not modest, doesn't matter? No. You see, that's how, just how crazy we are. He asked they described how she's dressed.
What did they say? She
wore, I'm sure they did. From what they were describing. Yeah. She was wearing rags. For a woman to wear clothing that have patches or shoes that have no... is a raya that they're very poor. He made an estimation that these poor people, they had no money to make a lot of... They couldn't buy one time. It's wealth. Who had money for flour? She can afford 1 pound, not 2 pounds.
What do you do with this? It's about
kosher. I know. So is good non-kosher food.
One second.
You can have hana. The problem is, no, you can't. You can't give it to a goy because it's considered challah. Challah is holy.
Well,
there's kedush. Well, what do we do now with our challah? I mean, same thing. Baltashkas. What's the difference?
So
but the concept is the same. No, you have to know where it came from. You have to give it to a kohen. Since there's tuma. Because of the tuma, we can't give it to a kohen. We have to burn it. And now that it got mixed, if it was challah, if you had a smaller amount, it's not even challah. But if it's already challah, okay. Why do we take challah in the middle of doing something? Why is there shiurim? And there are many, many other questions. And I want to share something very important. The Medrash says, everyone heard the Medrash, that the mitzvah of challah rectifies the original sin of Adam and Chava. It's a tikkun of the sin of the Chet Eitz Hadas. So let's understand what does that mean. And the best thing is to find more words from our sages. And there is a medrash I'm sharing you from the teachings of the Rebbe. There's a medrash that says that whoever does not separate challah is being mekayem avodah zara. And the Rebbe's insight came from the fact that there are other choices that we make, like anger, that's as worshipping idols. Mekayim, what does Mekayim mean?
To keep.
Mekayim means the idol is already there. And if you're not separating challah, you're upholding, you're giving continuity to Avodah Zarah. And the Rebbe points out that we don't find this expression in other places. In other words, it's not a sin like doing something bad. Mekayim Avodah Zarah, where is the Avodah Zarah in the dough before taking off challah? What's the sin of the Eitz Hadas? That's the bottom line. And this is something real. And that is, Adam knew that there is God. Adam and Chava, God spoke to them. We know there's God, everyone on their level. The challenge we all have is that when it comes to our relationship with Hashem, which also means my relationship with me, I'm confused, I don't have it right. Concerning, let me speak about power. Where is the power? Who has the power? And that's something that we all struggle with. Because we are taught, we learned, you know, Shara Bitachin, that I have my responsibility. There is part of my life that I have power, and I'm not supposed to lean on God. I have to do my part. On the other hand, there is a lot in my life where if I'm going to think that I am the power, I'm in control, avoid the zod on that level, then I'm taking something that's godly for me. I am taking the place of God. You know, when Pari says, I'm God. We all, Pari, Mamish said, I'm God. We all do that. It's not so foreign. Because Pari said it more than we do. Because he was almighty. He was Pari. But he saw himself being the powerful one, where God was the powerful one. When do we have this struggle? When might we be confused of me being the one in charge and not God?
When we're creating.
You know where we don't have this struggle? For example, when we're davening. When I'm davening, my whole disposition is, God, you're the boss. I have a lot of needs. I have a lot of whatever. I'm thankful. I'm needy. our challenge is only when I'm doing my responsibility, when I'm working. Making bread is not just about making bread, it's what I'm creating. And I'll tell you more than that. God, in the beginning, the bread, the Chazal tell us that off the stalks of wheat came a ready-made bagel, a ready-made uga, a ready-made cake, a ready-made challah. Can you imagine? And it's...
You didn't need to do the work.
There was no work needed. Well, let me reframe. There was always some work needed. That's what we just had at the Shara B'Tochen. You know what we needed to do?
Eat.
We needed to eat. Thank you. We needed two things. We needed to take it off and to eat. Which Hashem made it from the outside, even when it was ready. God does not want for us to do nothing. On the other hand, here's the challenge, is that when we are doing, understanding who is the doer, it's very confusing. And it's not fixed. There are many, many levels to that. And it's a tricky question, because if I'm going to attribute God where I was supposed to take responsibility, I'm taking God's name in vain. I'm not doing the right thing. But it's something that we all struggle with, because then the solution is like, no, it's all God. It's no, I have to do my part. So if I'm doing my part, then I feel that, hello, you know, can you thank me? The Gemara says a great story. I think it was Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon, one of the great Tanoim, that it's a funny story. It's a frustrating story. And this is our story. It's not his story. The story is that he had a very devoted wife, and this is not for us, this part. He used to bring afflictions upon himself. He chose to suffer at night. And in the morning, he needed to be healed. And his wife, with her cooking, she made lavish meals and healthy food, and she would bring him back to his koyach for many years until she discovered that he's bringing the affliction upon himself. And then she felt like, you want to bring the affliction upon yourself? That's on you. But she says, you don't have the right to make me work so hard. And you're eating up the wealth. She came from a very wealthy family. He was eating up all the wealth. She was very upset with him. So she told him that she's leaving. She left him. And she went to her parents' home. Nochanes, she had parents she can go to. And then she was curious to find out, like, what will her husband do? She wanted to know. Right, she was hoping that she sent one of the kids to look through the window and he's Nebuch starving. No, what happened was, the Gemara says, is that there were sailors nearby and there was a terrible storm. This might have happened 2-3 days before. And they were davening to God and nothing was helping. So they were Sfardim. You know, Sfardim, they don't say God. They say God of Rabbi Meir, God of the Baba Sali, God of the Rebbe, God of this, God of that. And when they said God of this Rabbi Lazar, everything calmed down. So they decided that we're going to come ashore, we're going to bring him lavish gifts. And when she sent one of her children to see how dad is doing, how miserable he is he already begging me to come home?
He was taking care of.
So she saw that everything that she made things lavish. He got exactly what was due to him. So what she realized, it's a greatness of, she realized, see, here's a contradiction, that yes, she gets credit for what she did. She was an amazing wife. At the same time, she also realized that this is God's doing. Now, I don't know how to make that really, really work, but this is the struggle that we have. Not to throw away responsibility, but when we do it, God is part of it. It's for sure not, well, my part is mine. My part, who's me? God gave me life. God made me koyach. God gave me the right education. God gave me the right seichel. God took away many other things that would have made me crazy. I could have been in a horrible mood. Who says I would make it? Could be I would be reacting towards something that I have no control over. At least that. And everyone grows there. So the chet Eitz Hadas is that no matter how little we did, there was too much recognition. I did my part. I picked it off the tree.
we get irritated with people, right? What's called the trust fund babies, that they go to work and they come home. Honey, I worked hard. And they say, what worked hard? What did you do? You wrote a check? And the guy says, yeah. You know, so this is the avodah zarah means that instead of giving God the power, instead of acknowledging the emes, I somehow misunderstood my role and I took the power. When do you feel that? When you're working. This mistake of avodah zarah, you only can fall into while you're working. So what's the tikkun of challah? That in middle of the work, mamash in middle, you did half of the work, it's already, and now you mixed it in together, but still you have to put it in the oven. I forgot to end one loose end. I'll come back to it in a moment. Now you have to take away challah. Separate challah and give it back to God. You're giving it to a kohen, you're giving it to God. And even when we burn it, the kavana is that's an acknowledgement that in my work, God is involved. I have to work. If I wouldn't have worked, I would not have challah. So I have my responsibility. God won't make the challah for me. I am doing the work and I'm going to give more credit to God than I'm giving to myself, because I still have to grow into that, to see more and more and more and more Hashem's hand in my work. And the Rebbe says a gewaldike thing. And that's why when Mashiach will come and there won't be tumah, why does a baker have to give one from 48 and a balabayas or balabasta, one of 24. Why? What's the logic? I know the simple logic is, if you're a baker and you're making so much, even though you're giving less, the baker gave less. Mm-hmm. He gave basically 2%. It accumulates to be much more. So when you give it to the kohen, 2% from a lot is a lot more than 4% from a little. That's the external logic. The Rebbe said no. The Rebbe says that people that actually are out there in the world and working, they already see more and more the hands of Hashem. And the whole thing is to be more open, to see God in everything. So the baker who's doing a business, a person who's in business, anyone here who's going to be in business, you'll see the hand of Hashem. And when you're not in business, even this is not to minimize the work in the home, you don't need as many miracles as you need in the world out there. On the other hand, you can say, yes, you do, but it's different. But this is the Rebbe's understanding of, you have to always look for God, but you'll find God quicker. Okay, I just want to end one thing. I missed one little detail, and that is that I spoke about the quantities. That's why I went to the quantities before the story. That let's say I have a dough of 5 pounds. I know 5 pounds is the bag that I buy in Smart and Final. That's 5 pounds. That's what we always do. I guess you make a bracha. And even if you don't need freezing is good enough for many people. I'm just giving you an etzah. It's good to make it with a bracha. I don't need 5 pounds. I don't make 5 pounds. I make half. I'm saying by me, I don't make any of it. My wife makes. But I'm saying that's one way of doing it. When you make challah, take a pound, take a bag. No matter how few people are there, and freeze the rest. Like this, you make a bracha. If I baked the challah and I forgot to make a hafrashat challah, so when you take it out of the oven, here's the catch. You have to have 5 pounds together. So it's not enough for you just to take challah off. You'll take challah off one of the breads that you made. But you have to first put them in a basket. Or cover them. Because covering them unites them. When we bake matzah, that's exactly how we do it. Because we don't want to waste time when we're baking matzah. We don't do afrashas challah from the dough of the matzah before it's baked. He takes it out of the oven. He puts everything in. You can watch in a matzah. They put it in a basket. And they make a bracha. The bracha of afrashas challah. And they take a piece of the matzah off one matzah, which is connected to everything else, to have the shear. Or if you're making 2.5 pounds or 1 kilo, at least gather them together. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, this is something practical. Push the bowls together. That's not enough.
The bowls touching together.
I have three bowls.
In my memory, first of all, what you are told is probably correct. From my memory, they have to be in the same keli, or they have to be covered.
So they're covered with their own individual towel. It has to be one towel for all three.
You know what? I'll follow up. That's what I was told. But don't forget, I don't make this. So since I don't do it. What you did was for sure good. Maybe you can upgrade it. Maybe.
Yep. Okay.
Just what I think. I mean, theoretically, it should be in one keli.
Okay.
And if it's not in one keli, then it becomes one keli because it's covered by one chuppah. So like this, you have to know that since halachically mashahu, don't be concerned about it. What the Yafa said is true. The minig is a kazais. I know that, but you don't have to be. Take a big handful. That's good. That's exactly what it means. And don't worry. And if you took half of your handful, it's also just as good. That's also kazais. Kazais, I think, is 1 ounce, and 1 ounce is not that much. I think a handful is probably more than what's needed. Kabetza, something else. I'll tell you what. No, kabetza means that if I'm washing to eat bread, if I am not planning to eat a kabetza, I don't make the blessing al netilas yadayim. I have to wash even for a crumb. I have to make hamoitzi lechem in haaretz for a crumb. To make birchas hamazon, I have to eat a kezayis. But to make al netilas yadayim, I have to eat a kabetza. And many people that we know don't eat a kabetza. People don't eat bread. I don't know. The people that I know around me, the opposite gender of people that live with me, don't eat that much bread. They think it's very unhealthy.
What if you're literally
eating
crumbs? Huh? Some people eat the crumbs, you know?
That's fine.
I heard you don't need to eat much.
Huh?
I heard you don't need to wash for that or make.
No, that's a mistake. That's a big mistake. You have to wash. It's like if I have a drop of water, I have to make a bracha rishayno. You know?
Okay.
The bracha achrayno only kizayis. And the kibetza is to make the bracha al netilas yadayim. That's right. If I'm not going to have, if I don't plan to eat a kibetza.
If it's like one slice
of
pizza
with an egg. 2 ounce. I know that we spoke about it many years ago when it comes to Shavuos. I know we're getting completely halachic class over here. But when it comes to the pizza, the example that we spoke here, I remember, was about the cheesecake. To make a bracha achrayna, I have to eat a kazayis. Cheesecake, you make a hamazoinus, we make a hamazoinus. Depends. If the little bit of the crust is only to make everything stick together, not for the taste, you make a shahakol. That's the way we paskin. If it's there also for taste, even though the majority is cheesecake, and the crust of mizonot is, we make a mizonis, to make a alamichya, I have to eat a kazayis. How do you measure the kazayis? Do I have to eat a kazayis of the crust? Which in a fancy cheesecake can mean a third of the cheesecake. Or, now that I made a mezoinus for whatever I'm eating, if I ate a kazayis of the cheesecake, I ate a kazayis. That's the same thing with the pizza. I mean, pizza has on top of it a lot of stuff. What they tell you, that's there. The things that they don't tell you, that's there. And some of them have a lot of it. So when you're looking for the shear, is it the shear of the dough? Or is it the shear of the zemachloikas about that? Huh? So we don't go by the olive that you know of. We go by 1 ounce, which is a lot more than the olive, a lot more than the olive that we know, which is very strange how it got there. I don't know how it got there. Why? What am I saying with all this? This is something very important. And this is a very important rule in life. We know this. I'm just going to say the words. That whoever has a trauma, which we all do, you can only heal it by going back to it the right way. And any therapy today, developing, all of the therapies, whether it is talking it out. You know, someone was told me, because I mentioned last week, that, you know, that what do? We either suppress or we express. And in my experience, talking about it, for sure the wrong way, will make it worse. Because then you're all, right? Everything is good. You go to your therapist and then you really get upset with each other. When you finally get better, you go again to the therapist. That can be many people's experience, because if you vent it, that's what I was saying. So what should you do? I said, stay with it. I spoke about it last week. So someone, a woman, this class is getting out there somewhere. So a woman sends me something that I just heard about very recently, a therapy called EMDR.
That with the eyes?
That was the eyes. Yeah. And the just don't know who, I never knew what it was. I just found out like momish a few months ago. EMDR is not a therapy in which you speak about the trauma. But the therapist, some of them don't even want to hear your trauma. They don't tell it to you. But it's dafka not to talk about. You bring yourself back to that which traumatic that you remember. But you don't remember. We have a lot of stuff that we repress. But that what you do remember. And while you bring it up, you don't vent it. So you're with it. They move their finger in front of your eyes. and they ask you to follow the thing. You ever heard about this? It's very interesting. And basically, you're looking to the right and you're looking to the left. And since you're back in your place of trauma, the movement of your eyes, perhaps walking, it's amazing how effective it is. Somehow, allows you to have a different relationship with that traumatic incident, which can never be changed. Let me just clarify a few things for people that are listening, for people that are not familiar with this world, that first of all, trauma, the challenge of trauma is how we react towards it, just to make that clear. And one basic difference between stress and trauma is that if I am in a stressful setting and I'm going to be reacting, let's say hypersensitive, just one way people react. Many people react by dissociating. Everyone has their own dysfunctional way of reacting towards. I want to speak about being hypersensitive. So someone was traumatized and they're very edgy. They're very edgy. Being edgy while you are in a stressful setting is good. Wait, I'm almost there. 1 second. That's good. Just before I'm getting there, trauma means that something happened to me, whether it's last year, whether it's 50 years ago, or even yesterday. It happened already. It's over. If the setting that is stress-inducing, that is edgy-reducing, that's dissociating-inducing, is gone, the problem with trauma is that all of us, to some degrees, will react later when there's no reason anymore. So I'm always edgy. I'm always hypersensitive. In other words, a person suffering from trauma is a person who has no control over their emotions. Why do they not have control over their emotions? Their emotions are reacting towards something minor, objectively minor. For them, it's not minor. They'll explain to you. No, for this reminds me of that. That wasn't minor. So nothing is minor. And who wants to be that way? I don't want to be that way. I don't want to be overreacting. Or many people, when they are in a horrible, stressful moment, the only way out is to escape in themselves. They dissociate. So they dissociate. For what? For something that's not so uncomfortable. Not compared to the trauma. So that's the trauma. So how do you heal the trauma? All of the therapies have one thing in common. The person has to actively engage in that. You have to go back to it. It means you can only fix the problem when you are back with the problem in a different way. The movement of the eyes, I'm just saying words. I never did it, so I can understand things, but it doesn't mean anything to me. Understanding is garnished. Having said that, it's that normally, things that we understand that are not overwhelming, that could be put into words, they settle somewhere in the left brain. And that which is beyond words, good and bad, is so overwhelming, the left brain doesn't know how to process it. Left brain is woman, Bina. It goes into the right brain. And we want to move it over. We want both parts of the brain to carry it. It's like if something is very heavy, even if you can't take away its weight, but at least let me have someone else schlepping it with me. It's funny that that's on me. In other words, I'm only using part of me to deal with something that's overwhelming. I want to get the other part of me involved. That's the eye movement. You engage both parts of your brain, and both parts of your brain somehow can manage something that already happened in a more manageable way. So your reaction, you're out of control, to some degree becomes more stable. It's not so volatile. Sometimes that's all people with trauma. Sometimes sometimes everything is great. And sometimes a person says, I know that something happened, but forget about that. That's giving everyone else power. Where's my power? I have no power over me because I'm suffering a trauma. So what do? You have to redigest the trauma in a better way. But you have to bring up the trauma. Go think about what happened to you or when people speak about it. Now you're doing it on purpose. You're doing it in the right setting. You're not doing it in an overwhelming way. You're speaking about it, if it's talk therapy, you determine how much do you want to talk about, and you know that you can stop talking. And many times people talk about it and they become overwhelmed and they start crying and they stop talking, and then they are able to talk a little bit more. So whichever technique you're working, they have one thing in common: if something is hurting and it's causing problems now, you will only fix it by going back to it. And that's the nakud of this point, that somehow when we work when we work, this is not all making bread. We have a misunderstanding of God, all of us. Doesn't matter how frum we are. We have a misunderstanding of ourselves. We see ourselves either to be powerless when we have power, all of us. And it's crazy how crazy we are. And we see God to be powerless. We become too powerful, we become too little powerful. We take power when we shouldn't. We give up power when we shouldn't. That's the meaning of Avodah Zarah. It's foreign. When do we do this most? Not when we're not working. When we're working and successful. When you're making a good challah, when you're feeling, I'm doing my part. No one makes challah like me. You're not going to say it, but that's what you're thinking. Nothing wrong with thinking that way. That's where you have to bring God in better. That's the tikkun of the Eitz Hadas. And that's where you take off challah. Taking off challah, like making people say, I'm making a bracha. I'm already making a bracha. I'm already saying Moed Ani. That's different. This is a mitzvah that you have to do in the middle of your work. And it's not like mincha for the men who are listening. Because mincha means I'm stopping to work. I'm going away from my work, not physically, mentally. And I'm closing my eyes and I'm talking to God. No, challah is in my work, in the middle of it. It's unique. It's something about the way we understand ourselves. Think about, what are you thinking about you when you're working? How do you see yourself? That's fixed by challah once we get it. But you have to go, no, it's this means that we can only heal something in the place of the wound, which makes a lot of sense. If a person has a cut on their left hand, they're not going to put a bandage on their right hand. But we all do that. We have a cut on the left hand, so we put a bandage on the right hand. That's the Chelem story. A guy was looking under the lamppost for something. So his friend told him, what did you lose? He says, yeah, I lost my wallet down the block. So they said, why are you looking here? Because the light is here. That's what we do. We go to God. We go to God in davening to fix the problems that we have with God when we work. You can only heal the trauma. You can only fix the mistake. You have to go back to the mistake. And that's why God makes sure for all of us that whatever needs to be fixed will keep on coming up. Because if we don't have the seichel to go back to it, which is a lot less traumatic, if we pretend, I got over it, God, I believe in you, but you don't do whatever we have to do, God will make sure it's going to come up again. And that's we all know that. That's why there are certain things that keep on happening to the person again and again, in this form and in that form. And a person says, what did I do wrong? Nothing wrong. The trauma is the gateway. The problem is the gateway to God. It's the gateway to yourself. You'll only know yourself through a trauma. And it's the gateway of your relationship between God and yourself. And that's what challah is. Yes, you wanted to add something.
So is that why we also say when we prepare stuff for Shabbat, or when we prepare stuff for Shabbat, we say in the Shabbat, or Shabbat for this, so it's to remind ourselves.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. And another thing that Rebbe says, unlike a bracha, because one of the questions the Rebbe asked is, well, how is it different than a bracha? He says a bracha is verbal. The Chavot Shabbos is verbal. And challah is an action. And the ultimate healing is when you do it differently. First, you have to think differently. Then you have to speak about it differently. You have to understand it differently. But the makabah patish, the end, is to do it right. To do it again. Because the sin was an action. They did something. That action had to do with them misunderstanding God and themselves. They thought too much of themselves. The nekuda. And we all have that. In other words, we're not doing this. We're not bowing down to a statue. Giving challah is fighting, is we're doing something that's saying, no, there's God is here. There's more God here than I'm giving credit to. And not in the wrong way. Because if you're going to say God is here, then the answer, like the story, then a guy can say, God, you're here, you make the challah. And then you'll go hungry. That's the challenge. God says, no, you have to make the challah. I'm not making the challah for you. And when you make the challah, you have to see that I'm making the challah through you. The only thing that I'm aware of in Kabbalah, and I know that this is something universal, that there are certain energy fields, certain mental states that we all get into if you were to lift your eyes upwards to a 90 degree angle. People that are stuttering, the brain waves, the alpha brain and the beta brain, and that's why you'll find, not by Chabad Rebbe's, purposefully not, but by many other Hasidic Rebbe's, that's connected to our class, you will see them in their videos that when they're singing and dancing, they're going to start rolling their eyes up. And in consequence, many foolish people who want to copy them, when they're davening, they're rolling their eyes up. And this whole class that we gave now is to point out that none of us, as a rule, we don't have a challenge relating to God in the holy. No, we're not bowing down to idols. We believe in God. Our challenge is connecting to God in our work. And going into these mental states is the opposite of what we should be doing, as a rule. The opposite. Challah means, you know when you can fix your relationship with God, not by going to the synagogue. You fix the Avodah Zarah when you are working. What are you feeling when you're working successfully? Are you taking credit the wrong way? And it's very difficult to take it the right way. It's not simple. Just say, it's all you, God. That we don't believe in it. We don't believe in that. It's words. Deep down, we take credit. And we have to take credit the right way. It's like we have to take responsibility. Easy to say, and give God the credit. Most of us, we give God the responsibility. It's your problem, God. You're doing this crazy thing. And then we give even though God, you're out of control, at least I'm giving myself credit that in this cruel world, I did something great. That's what many people believe in. Deep down, they don't admit it. It doesn't look nice. So we say we don't think that. That's the way we think, and we have to flip it. Somehow, we have responsibility, and we give God the credit in the right way. And there's growth, and there's growth. And we can only fix it without rolling our eyes. The going back and forth is not going up. Going up is sends you to the heavens. Going back and forth is taking the same event in, using more parts of your brain. I heard this. I just heard about this not that long ago.
But again,
the Rav Daniel
Katz, he mentioned, he told us a story.
Using both sides. It allows the same trauma to come back in because it's there anyways. And it's throwing it on two, not on one. And it really works. Especially for trauma from earlier years. Especially when a person is in their adolescent or when they're in that age. Someone told me that they're saying it's like 60% more effective than other therapies. Dafka not talking about it. Talking about it, they say, the person who I listen to, with the limitations, is they say that that's a lot more helpful for traumas that happened in our adulthood, or for traumas that we caused, for mistakes that we made, not for, because when we're very young, it's so overwhelming that part of the brain doesn't want to accept it. So it becomes too big because we made ourselves too little, not by default, not by choice, and we have to learn, we have to fight our way out of it. You have to fight. Another reason, just to finish, I know I needed to leave before, that again, I'm not a maven, and I'm not speaking negatively. The hesitation that I think everyone should have regarding psychedelics, the hesitation, is that even though people are saying that they have a different understanding, that first of all, if a person has real trauma, whatever trauma means, some people need it, no doubt. I'm talking about for a person that never had a certain level of violence done against them, and you have such people, more people than not were violated horribly. It's shocking. But let's say you don't remember, you're more or less, for people that don't have such a traumatic event, the advantage of not going to the heavens, which is psychedelics, to fix a mistake, that's the talk, that you have to heal something in the place of the wound, not in the heavens. Not, you understand, you're taking something, you're going to a very elevated place, you see yourself legamre different, And listen, for people that had real traumas, halavai. I'm saying if a doctor says you should do it, for sure you should do it. That was the Rebbe's approach. The Rebbe said that this is a mental health issue, and the rabbinate, we're not doctors. If a doctor says to do it, do it. But if a person was not told by a doctor to do it, by a professional to do it, even though many people are doing it, and they're coming back with wondrous temporary results, the proof for me is that they say they go every 6 months. That means it's not permanent. I think it will be a lot, ideally, to go back to the womb the way we're doing it now. You have somatic, all of these new therapies today, the good thing is it's not about talking. Because when you talk it, you can make it worse if you don't know what you're doing. If you don't talk about it, you're not making it worse. You're just seeing it differently. Hashem should bless all of us that we should make a lot of challah, we should do a lot of work, we should be very successful, and we should understand how much God is connected to our success. That's what we're looking for. And when we get that right, everything is healed. And when we get that wrong, everything is out of control, and out of control is something that we want to avoid. It's not comfortable, and there's hope, guys. We will all be healed.
Amen.
Okay, I want to share a few words. This is a short vort that is so important. We have in the Torah, not made up, we have in the Torah punishments attributed to the lack of certain actions. Or when God told us to be observant, there is in the Torah a link that if we're not observant, we will get punished. And it's very important to know what to do with that. What do I mean, what to do with that? I'll explain to you what I mean by giving a great analogy that I just heard. Great analogy. Especially when someone begins to drive, it's very helpful for them to watch a video to see what happens to the human body if there's a crash and a person is driving and they're not wearing a seatbelt. It's beneficial to watch that because it's devastating at what happens. However, when a person is driving and they're putting on the seatbelt, it would be a tragedy if that what they would be thinking about is, ooh, if I'm not going to put on the seatbelt, there's going to be an accident and I'm going to die a painful death. No. When you're driving, look out, look at the scenery, appreciate the wonder of the car that we don't appreciate enough. If you live in LA, look at the wondrous place that we live in and enjoy life. You're supposed to enjoy life. But why do you have to watch the video? If I will become reckless, I'm using this as a purposeful example, as I do sometimes with my seatbelt, and I feel, seder, at that moment, it's good that I have somewhere in my brain, whoa, one second. This is something extremely important, not that there's going to be an accident, but if there'll be an accident and you're not wearing the seatbelt, oy gewalt, what can happen? I think all of the punishments of the Torah should be viewed that way. If it says whatever it is that you heard, that if that's something that was not made up, then there is a truth in that. And even though it's a truth in that, that doesn't mean that while we're living Yiddishkeit, we should be living like, it's like driving a car petrified that I'm going to get into an accident and I'm wearing the seatbelt. That's not the way to live. When it says in the Torah, ubacharta b'chayim, choose life, what does it mean? That's what it means. Doesn't mean choose observance and not fry out. No, it means choose observance in a way of life. Have a normal relationship with Yiddishkeit. Even though it's good to know that certain violations could bring about devastation, okay, but I'm not living from that place. I'm using that as a backup, that if I'm getting reckless and lazy, then I should remind myself 1 second. I'm going to do this. Use it when needed. And most of us barely need it. And it's tragic to make the foundations of Yiddishkeit based on fear. There's no room for God if there's fear. You chase God out. All right, that was just put it out.